This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It is always wonderful to start a Monday on a good note, and today we can, with more encouraging news on the vaccine front from a local vaccine maker. Boston-based Moderna says that preliminary data from its coronavirus vaccine trials shows 94.5% efficacy. That's a big number, and it follows a similar announcement from another vaccine partnership last week. Here's Stephen Hoge, president of Moderna.
It's a really important milestone in the fight against the pandemic because it demonstrates that our vaccine, mRNA-1273, is able to prevent COVID-19 disease, including severe disease in people who've received it.
Now, the vaccine's still in trials, and there are many unknowns. There's more work to do. Still, as it becomes more clear daily that the virus is ripping through the U.S. again, and we won't have the kind of holidays we might have hoped would give us some relief from months of pandemic isolation, this glimmer of what could be on the horizon is welcome. In a few minutes, we're going to take your calls on what is and is not safe now when it comes to traveling right now during the pandemic. That's travel. The number to call with your questions is 1-800-423-8255. But first, let's learn a little more about this glimmer of vaccine hope from WBUR's Angus Chen. Angus, welcome.
Hey, Tiziana.
Hey there. So, Angus, give us the rundown. What do we know about the Moderna vaccine?
Well, it's definitely a very exciting day for Moderna. Their vaccine uses a new technology that uses a type of genetic code called mRNA. This basically just instructs your cells and your immune system to target a piece of the coronavirus called the spike protein. The coronavirus uses this to sort of attack and enter your cells. The vaccine works by getting your immune system to create defense compounds called antibodies that kind of gum up that spike protein and make it useless. The vaccine is currently in a phase three clinical trial. That's the final phase before federal approval. And there's about 30,000 people involved in that trial. Half of them got the vaccine, half of them got a placebo. And so far, what Moderna has told us is that there have been 95 cases of COVID-19 in those 30,000 people so far. 90 of them were in the placebo group, and 5 of them actually got this vaccine. So that's where this efficacy rate of about 94.5% comes from. That's really, really good. That's super. And if that number holds, then it suggests that this might be one of the most effective vaccines created, in at least in the short term.
So, second piece of good news in the last couple of weeks, let's compare this with the vaccine from Pfizer, which announced last week that it was more than 90% effective. That was in its first batch of data for their phase three clinical trials. Can you compare the two?
Yeah. So, Pfizer's vaccine and Moderna's vaccines are really similar. They both use the same mRNA technology. They both target that spike protein that we just talked about. When Pfizer announced that the sort of preliminary results of their trial, like sort of Moderna's preliminary results we heard about today, were over 90% effective, it kind of told us that all the other vaccines that are very similar to it, like Moderna's, are going to be similarly effective. There is one major difference between Moderna's vaccine and Pfizer's vaccine, and that has to do with its storage, actually. Pfizer's vaccine needs to be stored at super low temperature, like minus 70 degrees Celsius or minus 94 degrees Fahrenheit. And those ultra-cold freezers that can maintain that type of temperature are really expensive. Moderna's, on the other hand, can be stored in a regular freezer like the one you have in your kitchen. That means where Pfizer's could only be distributed from places from like sort of major urban centers or places that can afford those kinds of ultra cold freezers, Moderna's can basically go anywhere. They can be shipped to rural areas. They can be shipped, you know, to your local doctor's office. It's basically able to sidestep a huge logistical burden, huge logistical hurdle. And that's a major advantage. So here's what Harvard immunologist Barry Bloom had to say.
It will clearly be something that every physician's office, every clinic can keep it for 6 months in the freezer compartment of ordinary refrigerators.
That basically just makes it so much easier to distribute. And I think that, you know, in the coming months, if these vaccines are approved by the FDA, distribution and logistics is going to be quite a challenge. They do also share another a weakness, which is that they need two doses to be administered 1 month apart. So, you know, health experts kind of are are a little concerned that if you get the first shot, you might not be able to come back 30 days later to get that second shot, or you might miss it.
So wait, you might not be able to come back, or that people might not comply and come back in the appropriate time frame for that second shot?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's, you know, scheduling a doctor's visit, you know, exactly 30 days or in this case, it's 25 and 28 days isn't always the easiest thing to do for a lot of people.
So you've told us that this is encouraging for some of the other vaccines as well, Angus. So I want to jump ahead and ask you, what does this mean for the road ahead across vaccines? I know this is just the first step.
Yeah. So just because Moderna and Pfizer have hit this really great milestone, it doesn't mean all the other companies are going to give up, like, oh, they did it. It is a good sign for companies that have made the same kinds of scientific bets that Moderna and Pfizer have made, which is sort of using that spike protein and using this RNA technology. But a lot of other vaccines are also focusing on other targets. They're using different technologies to make their vaccines. There's still a lot that we don't know about Moderna's and Pfizer's vaccines. Like, we don't know how long they're going to be protective. And we don't necessarily know just yet if they sort of prevent disease in everyone or if they just kind of make the disease less bad if you get sick after getting the vaccine. So it'll be good for us to have kind of a sort of a plethora of different vaccines with different technologies available.
So Angus, briefly, just talk to us about getting people to take the vaccine. We touched on this a second ago. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, it's going to be a challenge, I think. You know, after the science is sort of handled, and we're still working on that, we're still working on these clinical trials, and we need to see the results of those before sort of charging ahead to the clinic. But once it's there, we've seen how politicized public health has been in this pandemic. Mask wearing and social gathering and even like hand washing, things like that, have all been politicized. And you have like groups of people who don't want to comply with sort of those health guidelines. A lot of health experts are hoping that won't happen with the vaccine. And it's going to take a really coordinated effort, I think, from health officials and health practitioners and other industries to make sure that the general public has confidence in this vaccine and the vaccine technologies being used here, and really make that decision to go to the clinic and get the injections. I think it's also okay. Important to note that, you know, even if you get people to take that vaccine, it's important to know our lives aren't going to change right away. We're not going to go straight back to normal, life as normal before the pandemic. You know, for one, we still need to see from the science, these clinical trials, if the vaccines really just attenuate the disease, like we mentioned before, sort of make that disease less severe, or if they're really kind of, and everyone who takes it and everyone where the vaccine works, actually can prevent getting disease. If that's the case, then we'll sort of get what we hoped for. This is what Dr. Chris Gill at Boston University had to say.
So we just don't know the answer, but if it's a disease transmission blocking vaccine, that is what puts us very clearly on a pathway to reopening society.
Yeah.
So we're gonna look forward to that, Angus. I appreciate you keeping us up to date on this. That's WBUR's Angus Chen. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Tiziana. It's a pleasure.
So now let's stay with the subject of the coronavirus, and we're going to take your calls. Our focus now is travel for Thanksgiving and around the holidays. I want to be clear, increasingly governors of New England want us to keep it small and keep it at home. But you might have to travel, or for example, you might have a college student who's got to travel home for Thanksgiving and not go back. Or maybe you still have questions about what's safe before you make a decision you're trying to make. So let us help with that. Call with your travel-related coronavirus questions, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. So here to help us out are Dr. Mark Seidner, a clinical epidemiologist at Mass General and an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, and Anne Lishway, a travel sales manager for AAA Northeast. Dr. Seidner and Anne, welcome.
Thank you.
Hello, thank you.
So, Dr. Seidner, just before we jump into travel, let me just give you a chance to provide your sense on what we learned from Angus just now on the vaccines. Are you feeling very encouraged, and is this glimmer of hope well-placed?
I think so. I think it's hard to remember that, you know, 10 months ago, this virus hadn't yet been determined, discovered, and not a year later, we have two now results of clinical trials involving tens of thousands of people, which preliminarily, and it is preliminary data, show some of the best vaccine efficacy data that we know. You know, we have to remember that many other vaccines tend to be about 50 or 60% efficacious, and this one so far in two preliminary studies is up at the 90% rate. And that really is, if it holds true and does protect both from infections and severe infections, as your columnist just suggested, is enough to get us out of this area and potentially towards a herd immunity where we can start returning to life. So I think this really is a time to take stock of really good news. We haven't had much good news this year. And so I think these two pieces of data in the last week really have made us much more optimistic that a COVID-19 vaccine is possible and potentially imminent.
So I think we're all going to look forward to that and to the chance that in the future, maybe next year's holiday season, we're going to be able to be together more as we've become familiar with. But clearly, that's not going to be the case this year. And I want to take us into the travel conversation now. And let me ask you, what is AAA telling its members about traveling right now and how to think about that decision?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that this year, more than any other time, travel is really a very personal decision. So I think it's something that each person has to look at the risk versus the benefits and figure out what the right thing for them is to do. But the most important thing this year, and that we're, you know, telling all of our travelers, is you have to do your research and you have to be prepared. However you plan on, you know, if you are going to be traveling this holiday season, it's important to know, you know, what the risks are for the different methods of travel, whether that's by car, which is going to be the large majority this year, or by, you know, plane or train. It's important to know, you know, how can I try to alleviate those risks for myself? So, you know, be prepared, know where you're going to stop along the way. If you're driving, bring your sanitizing wipes, you know, try to, you know, reduce as much as you can, you know, any high touch surfaces or, you know, any stops if you are driving. So I think it's more important than ever to be super, super prepared for any travel that you may plan on doing.
And Dr. Seidner, what are you telling people when they come to you and ask you if they should travel for Thanksgiving?
I tend to ask people to ask themselves three questions. The first question is, what are the alternate options? No one wants to have a remote Thanksgiving, but can it work? Is there a way that you can still enjoy time with your family over these holidays that don't require you to be in person in close encounters where COVID-19 transmission occurs? The second question is, for those who really are going to travel, is how do you travel safely? How do you optimize the safety of your travel? And I think we just heard some of those. An ideal situation for those who can do it, which may not be too many people, is to try to quarantine as long as possible before the date of travel. The best case scenario is a 14-day quarantine. And it's at that point when you're out of the incubation period where you can be relatively assured that you aren't infected. For those who can get access to a test before they travel, a negative test just before travel is also helpful. It can help reassure you that you aren't currently contagious. And I think for those who are traveling by car, trying the best you can to travel with people you're also cohabitating with. Don't take part in any new interactions during the actual travel itself if you can help it, for those who have that luxury. If you are going to be traveling, of course, while you're in the car, the plane, or the bus, strict mask wearing 100% of the time. As we just mentioned, hand sanitizers, do your best you can to sanitize the area around yourself. So just try to mitigate as much risk as possible. And then the third question is, once you're there, once you're with your family or your loved ones, what can you do to minimize risk during those encounters? And I think, again, these are things you've heard thousands of times, but strict mask wearing at all times, even amongst your loved ones. Of course, hand washing is important. For those who maybe live in southern states or in warmer climates, you know, keeping doors open, keeping windows open, potentially even an outdoor meal, if that's, of course, possible, which won't be up in the Northeast, I don't think. And also minimizing the amount of time you spend in close encounters. We now know that most of these transmissions tend to occur in close encounters, so less than about 5 or 10 feet for more than 15 minutes without a mask on. So anything you can do to minimize those events, again, will help decrease the risk of transmission.
All right, let's go to the phones. We are talking to Dr. Mark Seidner of the Harvard Medical School and Anne Lishway of AAA Northeast. They're taking your travel questions about the coronavirus. 800-423-8255 is the number. We have Rachel in Worcester, so let's hear from Rachel.
Hi, can you hear me?
I can, Rachel. Go ahead.
Hi. So my husband and I and our two young children, who are 3 and 6, were planning to visit my mother in rural Pennsylvania this year. My husband and I are both teachers, but we've been in, you know, limited contact with our students, and my son is in school while my daughter's in preschool. We had a lovely visit with my mom this summer in Maine, and we got our COVID tests, and everybody was fine, and I don't get to see her very much, so it feels like a really emotional situation. I worry when I'll get to see her again, and, you know, we don't have a lot of time off, so it feels like just so much pressure on this one situation, and I'm just feeling really concerned about what to do.
All right. Thank you for the question, Rachel. Anne, I'm going to start with you. If Rachel and her family should go, it sounds like you're saying the best way to go is straight on by car. Is that right?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that as, you know, Dr. Seidner mentioned earlier, that, you know, if you can travel within your bubble, that's kind of the best way to do it. And when they are, you know, if they do decide to travel and if they are traveling by car, you know, plan your route ahead of time and understand, when am I going to be stopping? Do I have to stop? Can I, you know, pack snacks instead of, you know, going to get food or get gas ahead of time, and really understand, you know, what that route will be. AAA also has a resource. We have a COVID map. It's AAA.com/COVID map. And you can both kind of plan your route there, but you can also look at what each state, what their restrictions are, and what, you know, if there is a required quarantine before or after, you can look at those details as well.
Dr. Seidner, you know, I feel like in listening to Rachel's call, what we're really getting at here is individual risk calculus. You know, she's talking about factors like how isolated she and her husband and her kids have been so far. The fact that she rarely gets time off, that she wants to see her mom and has only been able to once since the start of the pandemic. I think that's what a lot of people are dealing with. We know we should just stay home, right? You know, you should, but there are other factors that come into the mix. How do you guide people through that?
You know, this is just the challenge that we've all been facing for the last year. And I wish there was a simple recipe, a simple answer, or some sort of risk score, but as was mentioned, this is a decision that each of us has to make, and it's a personal one, and I don't think there is an easy answer or a right answer. I do think we need to keep in mind that the state of the epidemic right now in this country is poor. Cases are up, hospitals are full. There are 10 states in this country whose ICUs are close to capacity. What that means is that if someone does get infected, there may not be a bed to take care of older people. I wish there was an easier answer to this, but I don't think there is. I think each of us needs to ask ourselves, what is the risk benefit? Have a very open conversation with our loved ones, and know that if we do travel to visit our loved ones, we are unfortunately putting them at risk. It doesn't mean it's not the right thing to do. It doesn't mean it can't be done safely with masks, ideally with quarantines, with tests before you leave. But we just need to do it with our eyes open and realize that the decision to go and see our loved ones in the midst of an epidemic, which is potentially fatal for older people and people with risk factors, is something we should not be doing lightly.
Let's go back to the phones here. 800-423-8255. We've got Beth on the line from Gloucester. Beth, what's your question?
Hi. I was wondering what the thought was. We usually go out to dinner on Thanksgiving. What it is like to go to a restaurant on Thanksgiving in Boston, maybe to a nice one. What risks that entails, because I heard, like, you know, being 5 to 10 feet apart, and so that's probably not going to happen at a restaurant, maybe.
And Beth, who's going? Is it just members of your household, or are you talking about bringing together multiple households?
It would only be my household, a very small number of like 3 of us. So
okay, thank you for that.
Let's see our family.
Yeah. And Beth, my heart goes out to you about that last thing you just said. God, I'd love to see the family that I have in Michigan as well. I hear you. And what do we know about, you know, how well restaurants are being used right now? What is AAA advising people when it comes to restaurant usage, et cetera? And Dr. Seidner, I'll turn to you after that.
Yeah, I think similarly to travel, I think this is really about doing your research ahead of time. Anything that you can do to mitigate risks. I mean, as Dr. Snyder mentioned, if you can have an outdoor meal, that's ideal, although it's probably unlikely for the Boston area. But, you know, maybe looking at the restaurant and what their capacity is. I think you really would want to look for a restaurant that has very reduced capacity, and how close are you going to be, you know, as our caller mentioned, how close are you going to be to other tables? Again, I think it's risk assessment and figuring out if that makes sense. Maybe this is the year to stay home and have a home cooked meal to yourself, but that's a, you know, decision each person has to make.
Anything you'd want to add to that, Dr. Snyder?
Just to mention that, of course, meals are one of the few times where we really can't be wearing masks all the time. And so I think we've actually seen clusters of outbreaks and people eating together because of the fact that when you eat, your mask isn't on, and then therefore your risk of transmission goes up. So just one more piece of that puzzle, which of course doesn't make this answer any easier, is that when you're sitting in a room, especially a closed or an inside room, with a number of people, including perfect strangers who don't have masks on, of course, the risk is a bit higher. So just more things to think about, but meals tend to be times of transmission just because the masks aren't being worn.
I want to grab another call here. And again, we can take your coronavirus-related travel questions at 1-800-423-8255. Sue's on the line from Newton. Sue, what's your question? What's on your mind?
Hi, Tiziana. What's on my mind is I hear so many people, and honestly, including you and the two guests today, talking about personal risk assessment, that it's like really figuring out, you know, what's going to keep you safe. And I'm wondering how we can broaden the conversation in terms of travel and just in general moving through the world, how we can broaden the conversation from just what's our personal risk to how we might or might not be participating in spreading COVID, even if we are not personally feeling at risk.
Thank you for that really important point, Sue. I'm going to add one more call to this that I think we can kind of cluster together, and then I'll go back to our guests. We've got Catherine on the line from, I think it's New Hampshire. Catherine, go ahead.
Hi. I'm just wondering, I have a college student coming home this weekend, and then the rest of her semester will be online, and she's home for a couple of months. But we're just wondering about those first couple of weeks or days even with her being home. Should we have her quarantine in a separate part of the house, or she will get
and
tested,
Catherine,
actually. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, do you know how frequently the university where your daughter attends is testing people?
Yes, she gets tested every 4 days.
Okay, thanks. So Dr. Snyder, I'm going to turn to you for that second question, and then I'm also going to go back to this point with Anne about what about protecting other people. Dr. Snyder, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. So it's a great question. I think in as much as it's possible for her to quarantine for the first 10 to 14 days after she returns to her house, I think that's, of course, challenging to a child. But that of course, the more days under your belt, the safer you are. Now, if the education structure where she's in school is such that all of her classes have been remote, or maybe she's been in a bubble, and potentially she's even been quarantined before her travel home, all of that time can cut into that period of time. But the 14 days really is the window we'd like to see people quarantine to really make sure that they're out of the woods. And a test, you know, towards the end of that period, no matter how long it is, always helps to reassure us. In terms of that first question, I couldn't agree more. And I think, many parts of this epidemic, whether it's keeping ourselves safe, keeping our loved ones safe, keeping our community safe, or in fact, as the vaccine eventually hopefully becomes available, keeping the population safe, these questions aren't just personal, and it could be your loved ones when you return home, but it could be the person sitting next to you on a bus, or the person who's getting gas next to you at a gas station. Every interaction we take with strangers is a potential risk for a transmission. And so the caller is completely right in that when we make these decisions, we need to be making them as a community where we realize that every action we make these days doesn't just pertain to us, especially for young people for whom this infection doesn't tend to be as severe. When we make decisions about going out, about going to restaurants, about traveling, all the people that we interact with along the way are people we're making those decisions about, not just ourselves and not just our loved ones. And so I want to echo that question and those comments and to keep in mind that these decisions are much bigger than ourselves and even our direct families.
So Anne Leshway of AAA Northeast, and I want to turn back to you for a minute. I imagine that there are a lot of questions out there about the fact that these are moving targets. You talked about the fact that you can go online to the AAA site and see which states have different requirements about travel, et cetera. What are people's rights if they had already made plans to travel and now because of state requirements or virus status, et cetera, they have to change those plans? Are travel companies and vendors making that easier and less expensive to do, or is this just a rock and a hard place?
Yeah, I think that I would say one small silver lining that we've seen during this time, at least from a travel perspective, that travel companies and airlines have really pivoted and have allowed that flexibility that really is necessary at this time. I mean, I think we all know, you know, whatever plans you may have for, you know, for today may change tomorrow. And we've seen those day by day, there's, you know, restrictions that are changing. So most companies are really giving a lot of flexible options to either, you know, change their trip to a future date, maybe have a travel credit to use in the future. And I think that the caller brought up a really good point here that, you know, Dr. Seidner echoed about, you know, this isn't just about personal responsibility. This is about social responsibility. So I've been encouraged to see travel companies really trying to embrace that and looking at what are our safety protocols? Can we, you know, limit travelers or, you know, when we do reopen and travel can resume sometime in the future, how can we limit risks and really mitigate that? We've seen a trend bubble travel where you can book travel for your bubble. So there's those kinds of things that we're seeing. Again, this is still for the future, but I've seen travel companies really embrace that, you know, as much as they're able to for when we can get back to that time and be able to, you know, hopefully travel safely.
Okay. And Dr. Seidner, literally in a word, yes or no, to sum it all up, is travel inherently unsafe right now?
In a word, I would say yes, certainly more than we're accustomed to.
All right. Well, that is Dr. Mark Seidner, a clinical epidemiologist at MGH and an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, and Anne Leshway, a travel sales manager for AAA Northeast. Thanks to both of you for helping us out with this conversation today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's flooding on Morrissey Boulevard and on Boston's Long Wharf today due to a king tide. And these floods don't come as a surprise to Christopher Cook, who is the chief of Environment, Energy, and Open Space for the city of Boston. His office has been working on a series of climate resiliency plans, which are for Boston neighborhoods. Those include concrete plans to reshape our coastline in response to climate change and sea level rise. That's stuff like floodgates, tidal wetlands, floodable parks, seawalls. He's here to tell us more about it. Christopher Cook, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So it's an interesting day to be doing this talk about climate resiliency, because today Boston Mayor Marty Walsh was named chair of Climate Mayors, which is a group of city leaders who are pushing for action on climate change. That group's been around since 2014. Mayor Walsh has been engaged with it for several years. What does it mean for the mayor of the city of Boston to lead this national organization now? What does it say about where he fits in the climate landscape and where Boston fits in our understanding of how cities are fighting climate change?
No, that's wonderful. Thank you for asking that. Well, it means that Boston is a leader, and I don't think that comes as a surprise. You know, our climate action plan that we have in place is one of the most aggressive in the country. And obviously, our climate ready planning, which is how we adapt for our climate reality, is also very substantive. But I do think this is happening at an interesting time. Mayor Walsh was a co-chair of Climate Mayors, which was formed. It's a group of 468 cities, Republicans and Democrats, bipartisan, 48 different states, who came together because cities needed to take action on climate change, especially in the face of the United States withdrawing from the Paris Treaty. And now it's very interesting that Mayor Walsh is taking this leadership when we're about to have a partner back in the federal government. So we're excited about the opportunities to unlock some real times for federal investment and federal strategies that'll help cities on their carbon mitigation adaptation goals.
Just to clarify, you're talking about Joe Biden, the new president-elect who has been clear that he's taking climate very seriously. And it sounds like you're saying you think there's a real difference in having that kind of partner in the White House in terms of what a city like Boston can do.
We do. I mean, we know that this is an administration that is going to put science at the forefront of its decision making, but then also something that's really central to our climate action planning. It's also made sure that it's going to prioritize making sure that those who are most affected by climate change, and there's definitely some parallels between this and your previous topic, COVID-19, the socially vulnerable, largely people of color, the communities that are most affected are going to be most impacted by the climate crisis, making sure that they are involved in that decision making and they actually get to benefit from the opportunities around climate action as well. So we're excited about new federal leadership.
In looking at these resiliency plans, Chris, I think, you know, those moments where you're like, I thought I knew, but I didn't really know. You know, the scope of people who could be affected, of Boston residents, can you bring that home for listeners? Who, really specifically, who can be affected, how many people can be affected, and over how little time?
Yeah, so when we're talking about the vulnerability from sea level rise, which is, you know, just part of the climate reality that we're living with, right? So you think about the climate ready work, which we've been doing since around 2015. We then moved on to specific districts, right? So how will these individual neighborhoods be affected? So you start to look at neighborhoods like Dorchester, and you look at neighborhoods like East Boston and the Climate Ready Downtown reports that we just completed. And largely there, the threat is sea level rise. And so as you start to look at Climate Ready Downtown, for instance, you know, we have $200 to $300 million worth of adaptation proposed to protect climate downtown from sea level rise between now and 2050 and 2070, because you're largely looking at about 40 inches of sea level rise. And that sounds like a staggering amount of public dollars that would have to be invested, but it protects anywhere from $2 to $6 billion worth of assets. Now, perhaps more important than, you know, the monetary value of these assets is people. Because ultimately, that's what climate change is about. And that's what the climate crisis is about. It's about protecting people, protecting them where they live, protecting where they work, protecting how they get to work. So as you start to look at neighborhoods like East Boston and Dorchester, neighborhoods that are our most diverse neighborhoods, neighborhoods that have public housing, neighborhoods that can't move in a climate crisis, these are neighborhoods that we really have to adapt in order to incentivize to protect people. So that's why, you know, in Climate Ready Dorchester, one of the projects that we're most excited about is Moakley Park, which, you know, actually is surrounded by public housing on two sides. So if we're able to make a berm intervention there to protect us against sea level rise, we're actually protecting people who are most vulnerable from this climate crisis. That's the real opportunity of these plans. Yes, we want to protect value, but we want to protect people.
All right, so I'm going to ask you a challenging question here. You know, we've been seeing a ton of development over the last decade in the Seaport. And, you know, the Seaport District has been criticized for not being accessible to most of Boston's residents, for being too expensive, for not reflecting the diversity of Boston. It is clearly vulnerable to climate change, sea rise. I'm assuming it's going to take significant dollars to sort of retro protect that area. And yet it feels like we've built this area that's going to suck dollars that maybe could have been used to protect people who, as you say, have long time been residents and vulnerable residents of communities like East Boston and Dorchester. Was there a trade that should have been made differently maybe a decade ago in thinking about development, given the investments that are going to be necessary?
Yeah, well, what's interesting is, in, you know, as much as I would love to go into the time machine, I think there is a strong consideration moving forward about establishing some sort of value capture system. So what does that look like? You know, is that, you know, tax incremental financing, or is that another, you know, bid like we have around downtown or the Rose Kennedy Greenway? Or is it a conservancy type model to actually look at some of these adaptations and figure out not only the capitalization of these, because that's often not the problem. The problem is not necessarily building the adaptation. The problem is actually taking care, the operations and maintenance of the adaptation over
so
time.
So I'm just going to pause you there for a second, because I just want to use more concrete language for people. When you say building an adaptation, what is an adaptation? Is that like the berm around Moakley Park? Is that an adaptation? When you
mean? Yeah, that's a great clarification, because it can mean a lot of different things in different contexts. So that could be elevated harbor walk. That could be a park that is designed to flood, not only from sea level rise, but potentially it's also a park that's designed to flood for stormwater management purposes. It could be elevated park. Basically, it's an intervention in the public realm that is done for a climate benefit.
Okay. Now, one of the things that was striking to me was the range of adaptations that are proposed in these readiness plans, these resiliency plans across, you know, Dorchester and East Boston and the North End and downtown. And it strikes me that many of them actually produce basically positive externalities around environmental justice as
right.
well. Am I just being overly hopeful, or how does that work?
No, you're not being overly hopeful at all, because that's really the twin benefit of taking a nature-based solution approach to climate change. You know, as you start to look at, you know, coastal wetlands and coastal tidelands, you know, the great benefits that we have when we visit these places is large open space, you know, to recreate. And we think we have an opportunity as part of Mayor Walsh's vision around resilient Boston Harbor to adapt our 47 miles of harbor walk to enhance it. So, yes, we would have the benefit to protect us against sea level rise. But when you start looking at a project like we're completing next month in the North End, Langone Popolo in the North End, you know, this was a park that was scheduled for a $6 million renovation. It would have resulted in a great athletic field. But by investing $13.5 million in it, we've actually protected it and the neighborhood through 2050 from flooding. So you have this great benefit of an enhanced harbor walk, an enhanced space for people to play at, and actually enjoy and, you know, receive all the great health benefits associated with open space. But you also have this climate resiliency built into it. One last thing I would say is what you pointed out is it also gives us the ability to further adapt these spaces down the road, you know? And so if we had to, you know, intervene again in order to protect us with new flood projections, we could do that.
So we're talking to Chris Cook, who's the Chief of Environment, Energy, and Open Space for the City of Boston. We don't have a lot of time. There are like a million things I would ask you. I think one that seems really important is there's no... You just talked about, you know, 40 plus miles there. That's going to be public property, private property. A lot of different players have to be on board for the various mitigation strategies you're talking about to happen and get paid for. I'm worried that that's just not realistic, because we're talking about a lot of cost up front, granted, even for a lot of big back end benefit. How do you get everyone who has to be on board on board?
Well, I think you're right to call out the partnerships, right? And so Mayor Walsh has dedicated 10% of total capital budget in the city for climate resilience. So that's anywhere from $20 to $30 million. But as you pointed out, these are large, expensive, expansive projects that are going to need assistance. So we're going to need private
sector. Right. I mean, that one park you just talked about was $13 million.
That's right. That's right. So we're going to need very, very strong private sector participation, especially at looking at through the opportunities of redevelopment. But then again, this is the real opportunity. As you start looking at having a partner in the federal government, you look at things that the federal government could do to actually incentivize adaptation strategies for cities right now. Well, you could take these adaptation plans. These are projects that are largely conceptually designed. If they were funded, we can build them.
All right, so I think the other little skeptical buzz in the back of my mind is when it comes to questions of environmental justice, our most marginalized, our most vulnerable always wind up with the least investment. So how do we make sure that Dorchester, East Boston, and the residents who are already most vulnerable to environmental impact really get their needs met here?
Well, that's why you have to put them at the center of the decision making, right? So if you look at both our climate action plan, which is our mitigation strategy to deal with greenhouse gas emissions, or if you look at the climate ready plans, which is how we're going to adapt for the climate crisis, the public outreach and the public decision making, you know, what do you want your public realm to look like? You know, what are the cost benefits associated with this? What are the enhancements that you want to see in your neighborhood? The last thing we want to do is we don't want to contribute to displacement. So we want to make sure that we're connected to our housing strategy, we're connected to our economic development strategy. And when there are opportunities for people from socially vulnerable communities to actually benefit from these adaptations, we want to make sure that we're making it accessible to them in every way possible, not only in the building of it, but also in the enjoyment of it as well.
All right, last question for you. There was some other news from the city today. They released plans to accelerate the use of electric vehicles in Boston. That includes some unveiling of electric vehicle charging stations today in JP. There are some coming in other communities like East Boston, Mattapan, Dorchester. How optimistic are you that electric vehicles are a part of the solution and that this initiative is going to get them on the streets?
No, I'm totally optimistic. Listen, electric vehicles are a proven commodity. I mean, you know, they're economical, they're quieter. You know, anyone who's worried about how well they run, they're absolutely fantastic. You should try it out. But one of the barriers you have in an urban setting is, you know, people who live in apartment buildings, you know, where are they going to be able to run their cord to actually charge their EVs? And so we're really excited that our forward-thinking streets cabinet with the transportation department is actually going to be putting EV infrastructure into these public parking spaces, you know, and so people will actually have an opportunity to have an EV charger in their community that they can access. I think that'll be a game changer for adoption.
Fantastic. That's Christopher Cook. He is the Chief of Environment, Energy, and Open Space for the City of Boston. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
Last night, Patriots fans who have spent the season wondering what could have been as they pressed their faces against the TV screen glass, watching Tom Brady light it up in Tampa Bay, they got a little something that everybody wants right now. Hope. Let's check the score with Radio Boston's Chris Siderick. Hey, Chris.
Tiziana, I told you that Tom Brady thing in confidence. How could you put me on blast like that? Come on.
Right up against the glass. So I like that there's a couple of things that are hopeful to talk about today. Tell me about the hope of which we are speaking in this case.
Yeah, we are going to keep the good feelings going because last night the Patriots came up with a huge win over the Baltimore Ravens, 23-17 in the absolutely pounding rain. I say it's huge because basically this was a must-win to keep their playoff contention alive and potentially even keep the division title alive. The Ravens are considered, you know, one of the best two or three teams in the AFC. It was actually the first time the Pats were a home underdog since 2014. And over their last five games, they were 1-4. That one win against the Jets, we talked about that last week, they barely squeaked that one out. So this was a huge win. They really needed this win to stay relevant this year.
Chris, why does it feel so good to have something to cheer for? To be able to say, we don't have to feel, you know, sort of hopeless or worried about this team. We can actually be excited.
Well, I mean, we all need some good news right now, right? We've been kind of stuck, isolated, and trying to get through what seems like day after day of more bad news. So I think anything positive that we can kind of feel that we're a part of is a great thing. We've talked about the community of sports and the way it brings us together. And I think that's what this team potentially could do. Now, I'm getting a little ahead of the game here because this is just the one win. They're going to need to do pretty well the rest of the season. They can lose probably one more game and still have a shot at the playoffs. But what you saw last night was really promising. You saw this hard – do you know smash mouth football? Do you know what I mean if I say that, Tiziana?
I'm assuming I know what you mean, but I'm not particularly
so there's
familiar
lots
with
of
the
teams
term.
There's lots of teams that win with kind of a lot of trickery and a lot of kind of flashy offense. Smash mouth football means we're going to line up, we're going to kind of show you what we're doing,
yep.
And we're just going to be more physical than you are. And we are going to impose our will. And that's exactly what the Pats did last night. They ran the ball hard. And I think they chose their situations in terms of passing wisely. And I think that's what they're going to need to do to be successful. It's all about execution that way. It's about doing what you're trying to do better than the other side. Let the other team make the mistakes. It's a very Patriot approach. I will say, in terms of the flashiness and the trickery, there was one notable exception last night, and I just have to take a minute to highlight this here. This is with just about a minute left to go in the first half.
They've had a pretty good run in this area over the past couple of decades. Now the pass goes to Myers, and it's behind the line of scrimmage, and he's going to throw a high school quarterback he was, and Burkhead will make the catch in the end zone.
Okay, now a lot of listeners are not going to get why that is so cool. But talk about being imaginative about how people can bring their best stuff to the team and the field. Explain what it means for Myers to have been passing.
Yeah, so Jacoby Myers is usually a receiver. He lines up, he runs his route, and Cam Newton will throw him the ball. He takes a step back, so he's behind the line of scrimmage. Cam throws him the ball. That means that Myers can still throw the pass downfield. So he throws a long shot to Rex Burkhead, who has got two guys kind of draped on him, and there is a tiny, tiny window to fit this ball in, but Rex Burkhead makes this catch sliding to the ground in the soaking wet grass, soaking wet football. Unbelievable play to take the lead going into the half, which is a huge deal. And I talked earlier about attention to detail. There's one thing I have to play for you here that I think is really interesting. There was actually a tell on this play. If Baltimore was paying close enough attention, they might have noticed what was coming, because I'll let Cam Newton describe the conversation that he had with Jacoby Myers after they decided this was going to be the play call coming out of a timeout.
I said, bro, don't panic now. He said, man, I got to take off my gloves. I got to take off my gloves. But I'm gonna do it so they won't recognize nothing. So he took off one glove, then he takes off another one. I'm like, bro, what are you doing? He said, I gotta take off another one, bro. I don't know. He did pretty good without being able to, you know what I'm saying, warm up or anything. And Berkey, you know, only thing he knows how to do is just score a touchdown, seems like, man, and he just made a big play for the team.
So I just love, that little bit of detail just shows creativity and a little bit of courage and mixing it up in kind of a panicky moment to try something different. Where is this all coming from? This honestly kind of hasn't been the Pats of the last several weeks.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that, because I'm flashing back to when we were talking about the games last year, and the team was 8-0 at one point, and we were talking about how unhappy everybody sounded. But you can hear the joy in Cam's voice as he's saying that. And I think that really speaks to what they're building as a team. And it's what the Patriots have been about as a franchise. I mean, this really, folks are going to say I'm jumping the gun here. And I'm not saying this is the 2001 team. But it reminds me of that feel, that team mindset where you don't have necessarily the biggest superstars on the field. But if you flash back to that 2001 team that won the Super Bowl, they were 14-point underdogs. Nobody thought they had a prayer to win. But they,
and that was for listeners, that was Tom Brady's first year, just to be clear.
Exactly. He came in and you know, it was a 6th-round draft pick, and no one really kind of knew what they were dealing with. But it's this whole mindset of out hustle, out work, out prepare the other team. And I just think it's really interesting. I want to play really quickly Bill Belichick describing the win last night.
Really, you know, proud of the way the guys competed. And you know, I think we just got to continue to work hard and grind away and, you know, see if we can improve and do some things better next week than what we did this week. But we just keep making steady progress. You know, we're definitely headed in the right direction here.
So grind it out. That's going to be the plan here on out. They've really got to just outwork, outprepare the other team, do the little things right. And, man, it's fun to see bad weather football. That was a treat to watch last night.
Well, it was a treat to talk to you about it. That's Radio Boston's Chris Sitterick. Chris, thanks for checking the score.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Sitterick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Our engineer today is Jimmy Kiesling. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi, and I'm Tiziana Deering. Glad you joined us on this Monday. Hope you'll join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.